Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Margaret Gibson's sixth collection, Earth Elegy, New and Selected Poems, was released this year by Louisiana State University Press. Among her other volumes are Long Walks in the Afternoon, the 1982 Lamont Selection, and Memories of the Future, the Daybooks of Tina Modotti, co-winner of the Poetry Society of America's Melville Keane Award. The Vigil, a poem in four voices, was a finalist for the 1993 National Book Award. Recipient of a National Endowment of the Arts grant and a Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Teaching Fellowship, among other awards, she teaches half of each year at the University of Connecticut, where she is a visiting professor, and otherwise lives in Bradford, Pennsylvania, where she writes. Gibson's poems, like nature as she describes it in A Ripple of Deer, A Metamorphosis of Bear, A Metaphor of Mountains, are psalms of wild solitude, meditations that travel beyond narrative in any conventional sense, although the self talking to the self is how we make our stories. Here, though, the contemplative process does not exclude us, but rather seduces the reader into the living moment, not as witness, but as a participant in its emotion, felt more than seen or heard. Carolyn Forshay puts Gibson in Rilke's camp, remarking on the poems in Earth Elegies as examples of what that great poet has called the natural prayer of the human soul. Soul, a territory few contemporary writers dare to navigate. But, as Gibson tells us in the title poem in Earth Elegy, I have not suffered, endangered, or enjoyed enough of this world to relinquish it for another only made real by dying, or by living in the holy world of words, apart from what they point to. Because the body insists on its perpetual refrain, I want, I want, these sure-handed lyrics find spirituality in the sensual experience of blossom, bark, and root. Harvest Elegy concludes with an evocation of the speaker at the kitchen sink, holding a just-dug yam, holding what she knows, her mute, imperfect hand, closing over this yam tightly, more tightly closing, afraid to let go. Please welcome Margaret Gibson.
Okay. I'm delighted to be here. How's the mic? Okay, it's not going to blip out. Okay. I'm delighted to be here. This is a beautiful room. It's a wonderful place to give a reading. And it's so different from the world in which most of these poems are set. It's astonishing to me. I mean, I live two-thirds of a mile back a dirt road in the woods in southeastern Connecticut, with a lot of shag bark and swamp maple and deer and wild turkey and an occasional song dog, which is a coyote. And all of these poems are, most of them at any rate, are either set there or in the wilds of Pennsylvania, which are much wilder than where I live in Connecticut, in a little town, in a field near a little town called Eldred. So this is liable to be a shock to be in highly sophisticated, energetic, and urban Chicago and to listen to my poems, but here we go. Okay. There are two epigraphs to the new and selected Earth Elegy. They're both from Rilke's Duino Elegies, and I'll read one at the beginning of the reading now and then one at the end. Voices, voices, listen, my heart, as only saints have listened, until the gigantic call lifted them off the ground, yet they kept on impossibly kneeling and didn't notice at all. So complete was their listening. Not that you could endure God's voice, far from it, but listen to the voice of the wind and the ceaseless message that forms itself out of silence. I'm going to begin with a poem from Long Walks in the Afternoon called October Elegy, in which the speaker of the poem is doing just that, listening to the voice of the wind and the ceaseless message that forms itself out of the silence. October Elegy. Precisely down invisible threads these oak leaves fall, leaf by leaf in low afternoon light. They spindle and settle. The woods open. Birds no longer slide by without my noticing loneliness in the bold stare of the night sky, a sphere tight as an onion. At night I wake to a cry like the tearing of silk. I listen and listen. There is only an owl, again, owl. A dog barks, a clock persists, its parody of single-mindedness, heroic. Then mornings, they begin in mists that lift toward noon, but first, as if you've dreamed them in a deep breath inward, the trees come shyly forward like ribs. Then the doves, their breasts the color of hewn cedar, call and vanish. No one, you beautiful one, just beyond grasp, slide your fingers along my arms as gently as you slide down oak and beech and shagbark, loosening the leaves. Who's attached to you? No one. Who could be? In ordinary commotions of grief and joy, you're elusive, a radiance that flashes so strangely, different each time or so seldom. We say of you, once in a lifetime. Remembering perhaps phragmites on fire in salt marsh light where river crossed into the sound, or the blow of light that glanced between mother and father nakedly, once, just once, laying the fire. Remember how I whistled, myself entirely, and no one. No one would say this. You may as well laugh in delight, cut loose, interpret in a moment's surrender your heart. I watch the oak leaves fall. Surely by the time I'm old, I'll be ready. Surely by then I'll have gathered loose moments and let them go, no longer dreaming on the stair, sun hazy. Surely not the old woman who thinks that by 90 she'll wake once, if a split second only, and live. No one. If I were able to forget you or find you, I might learn to enter the cup I am washing, door I am closing, word I am opening with careful incision, lover or child embracing, and fall toward that moment fire cracks from common stones, a sunrise in evening. I was reading a lot of, I was actually reading Thomas Merton's book called Birds of Appetite during the time that I was writing these elegies, and he was writing about Buddhism. And I guess the idea of a sort of core emptiness was so frightening to me that I immediately personified it and turned it into no one. But in fact, many of these poems are in search of that kind of core identity, beyond what is said on your resume or even in lovely introductions such as Paulette just gave. Who are we really? This is a poem called Glass Elegy, again set in the woods. I don't think there's too much to say here. Glass Elegy. The day she went mad, she watched white sun emerge from the oaks, shaking loose the dark as you'd knock garden dirt from an onion. At breakfast, though we're just now putting in seed, her talk ran to harvest. Out here, she said, I'm transparent, a single bloom in a glass bowl of water. I don't need mirrors. I don't need field. Later, she came back to the house, scattered. Her hands had flown from her like birds in high wind, vanishing in a rent of air between trees. During the worst, she lost her eyes, her ears, her tongue. The glass bowl cracked. She couldn't recover her collarbone, her right foot, her left breast. And because I'd learned to talk to her as I would to myself alone in a room, I tried to go with her, eyes shut into the suck of black wind. Hold still, she cried. She'd been so long in front of mirrors, an image in glass, a glass bloom in a bowl, and when she broke through, the woods moved in quick, everything out there verb, quicksilver changes, and these swallow you unless you turn mirror yourself and the world flashes from you each moment. And then she was quiet. I can't account for her words that morning, what she later saw, or the calm finally out of which she spoke with such authority. She described a random long walk in the afternoon when the woods breathed with her, and she lived through the power of death and the earth's rotation. As ordinarily you do, she said, if you're ready to notice. In the mirror that evening, dark branches tangled, weaving my face with their fire, and almost I could reach through and touch the ripening, long sweep of wind toward morning. I thought I'd start by reading a couple of earlier elegies, because there are other elegies in the new poems that begin this book, but they are somewhat different. At least I think they are. I mean, there's a difference to the quality of the longing here. And I'm going to read a poem called Harvest Elegy. There's also a difference in the way the natural world appears in some of these poems, many of these poems in the opening part of the book. Nature, the earth, has always been important in the poems, but for the speaker, as a way of understanding self or seeing self, knowing self, that wonderful seedbed of metaphors which the natural world is. And we are part of it, not separate from it. But in many of these poems in the opening section, the concern is also for the world or for the earth as such and its terrible vanishing. Harvest Elegy. This poem, by the way, is set in Bradford, Pennsylvania, a small town in the upper end of the Appalachian chain. The sun rises into itself pale gold, rising with it the whole valley, far hill of gravestones and hedgerows, houses, paved walks, streetlights, streets. You have gone out early to walk the hills, the blue ridges of shale and thin soil rising in a clarified space that closes the distance between us. Sun turns the window bright amber. It flares in the ridged veins of my hands, washing this yam, scrubbing it, scouring this last of the harvest to a shine with the palms of my hands. No dirt on the root now, none in the shallow eyes, none in the nick my shovel gave it. The yam so keenly polished it might be amber, a mirror cleared of dust. Or the mind I think I want when I sit tenaciously to quiet my thoughts, to kill them, really, forgetting to let mind be mind, turning as it will. Now more than the root comes to rest in my hand, shining, the whole earth of it, rising with tamarack, hemlock, black cherry, nurse logs, dense sprays of arrowy fern. And just where earth meets air, here and there in the shade, the clean smell of oil oozing up on its own, the smell you love, breathing in with it those endless afternoons of your boyhood, the roustabout and rowdy energy of an oil boom town, its swell of profit and plunder, so easy to deny. All this I let rest in my hand, finally able to feel these lovely woods scraped down, scoured to a final stump, these hills raw in rain light, house after house emptied of breath, blackened rivers, eroded fields, distant cities left empty or razed, and God knows what animals, birds, one species, an hour, vanishing, this earth a breath for nothing, not even this light left to rise in gold and hinged shadow through the bare black trees. Remember the veery, full-throated, how we listened at rest in the field, grown light in our bodies, doubled notes descending in harmony lightly. And just look at me now, standing here at the kitchen sink, thinking my way toward love, learning to distinguish harvest from theft, my mute, imperfect hand closing over this yam, tightly, more tightly closing, afraid to let go. I read a long meditation once called Making Salad and had to say, you can tell it takes a long time to get dinner on at our house. You can tell it also takes a long time just to do breakfast or whatever. I'm going to read another poem about walking around in that part of the world. This one's called So Entirely Vivid. One of my endless fascinations and something I do with my students in class very often is to look at things. I mean, to really look at things. There is nothing stranger in this world, for instance, than a green pepper, if you really look at it. And if you wander around the world in the attitude of inquiry, you know, what is this, what am I looking at this, and so forth, the world becomes a treasure house. And that is the mood in which the speaker is walking around in this poem. And I'd ask you to remember, sort of toward the end of the poem, you probably will anyway, just in the course of the poem, but that wonderful photograph of the Earth seen from space when we finally got off of here far enough to look back and see what we were and what we looked like at a distance. So entirely vivid. All day I've walked the hills, riding the curl of them into the night, still unable to grasp the fresh riddle of sycamore, barred owl, hawk on the wing of the wind, barrow moon. Nearly home, I pause for a long time beneath the chestnut tree across the street, its fragrant cones long since tamped into the earth by rain, the smirched petals sucked into the long roots that buckle the brick sidewalk, each brick cast with stars that bear me up. I look beyond the dorsal tilt of the roof lines, beyond the wind-mazy maples and their tangles of xylem and emptiness and phloem, to the stars we have linked and called Orion, like a flowering branch, that spray of exploding densities arching, so entirely vivid that I receive the sky, I take it in, I let myself be lifted into the cold blue ground of knowing I am the breathing space in which Earth moves, the time in which Earth lasts, the love that gives it life. From here, lifted up, I cannot help but see the earth is not a glossy blue and white celestial plum suspended in emptiness, only there for the taking, but an eye serenely looking at itself, serenely looking. I went around looking at sycamore trees for about 5 years. I was absolutely mad on the subject. I was dazed by sycamores. I don't think I know where any of them are in Chicago, but back east I have a whole map of sycamore trees in my head. For instance, the one in Kilbuck, Pennsylvania. For instance, the one in Central Park, New York. For instance, the one in the woods where I live, etc. A whole avenue of them in Marietta, Georgia. Anyway, I was a good student. I sat at the foot of sycamores. I studied their bark. I studied their leaves. I studied the light. I had notes, endless notes on sycamores, but no poem at all. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. There was no poem. And then one day my mother casually mentioned that my grandmother, a woman she hadn't loved particularly, had loved sycamores. Well, that did it. And that is, I think, really a rather instructive history, because most poems have a two-pronged subject. There's the one sitting up front, and then there's the one in the shadow that object, in this case the sycamore trees, was looking for to link up with. So this poem, Sycamores. This is also a poem about love. Perhaps I love the sycamores along whatever edge of bottomland, creek ledge, town avenue, or river path I walk, because I did not love my grandmother, who sucked her teeth after dinner and offended the laws of the house by being no less selfish than anyone else, just as pious and none the wiser. I watched her brush her knee-length white river of hair each night. I watched her coil it back into a loose braid and deliver herself to prayer as a child would, kneeling opposite me beside the bed and quickly because it was cold. I heard her mumble bless and sin and lost the rest by wondering how hair knew how long to grow down her back and then just stop, no need to cut it. Perhaps something in us, wise or unwise, just says in a small voice, don't, or I can't help it, or I won't. I don't know why I didn't love her. And she loved sycamores, I come to learn, too late for any reparation, and the bond my loving them also might make seems flimsy. Love for its own sake takes years and is hard. But just look at those trees, each limb rippled like hair unwound from a braid, their rare, undaunted ease of just being. Branch by branch, a gnarly veer, late to leaf, patchy white. Then a reach so sheer it carries the eye beyond its own uncertain radiance or grief. Okay, a couple of more love poems in the sort of elegiac mode, I guess. These both set in Mexico, Cuernavaca, or outside of Cuernavaca, along an incredible ravine. And these poems are companion poems, so I think I will just simply read them without more than just a pause between them, but no comments. At the Ravine. Within the interpreted world of stone walls and a bougainvillea trained to bloom into the body and beak of a bird, exotic plumage kept to hand and rooted, you have pointed out the prickets of epiphytic bromeliad kindled by early sun in the spreading tree across the ravine. Candelabra, you say, smiling to recall how your mother, new to the language, said candle bras. And so the conversation rambles into a thicket of resemblances, nothing singular but ourselves, and we hide our light. We have binoculars and two books to tell us the words for the birds we may see across the ravine, the land on the other side gone baroque with erosion, red rocks in twists of arabesque, open sky, thin pasture. Nothing stays, nothing keeps us steady. A white horse dips its neck, it's a swan. Swan drawn by a child, faint cirrus and cumulus, body a cloud propelled across the surface of a pond in whose depths, as I remember, the child has drawn the feet black and churning, passion and muscle translated into act. More exact an emblem than Rilke could give for the love a woman feels for a man she can't have, going away from her, his body far horizon, ripples of ridges and hills receding into rain, and yet the wick of her still burning, burning. Look now, you say, just there, and I find the tree as a flash of gold comes steadily to flame, ripe red and mango preening, its back streaked black and white, clearly aureole, immature form, none other like it in the book we decide. I lean over the wall, over the ravine, Barrancosa, glad to be warming my hands, reaching across to a moment of sun embodied, fleet. We have, seeing the bird, seen each other, passionate and detached at once. The way one can take what comes, love it fully, and setting free say, yes. Icterus sclateri, aureole, magnificent, yes. Blessing. For months, like a miser counting gold, I hoarded that first day in Tepeyac, the market of souvenirs and day glow saviors, yellow tarps stretched wide enough to catch sun and lift light from us. And the milagro I bought, flat tin painted gold, replica of a woman's life given such clarity she might wear it lightly on her skin. And the sun, whose haloed arco iris rippled like oil on water into the dirty air, much too bright for me to see in full detail what, wanting to know you, I could not see when you stood with me in the hushed capilla, both of us close enough to touch that woman in her flowery shawl, standing flush with the altar rail, her one coin held like a rising sun between her fingers, her hand a sweep of sun and rain over the body of her man, over his closed eyes, over nose and ears, lingering longer at his mouth, the coin an arc of light along his shoulders, down his arms, over back and belly, a dip down to the groin, the coin now so blessed that she can, touching last her own lips, let it fall into a basket nested in the fire of candles. I watch them shimmer. This memory ripples off into luminous emptiness. I don't know where you are or how, as I write to tell you what. That tonight the moon, full as a prayer wheel, falls branch by branch, slowly down bare cedar silhouettes to the wet skin of the pond, giving back the gold of a day elsewhere given. And bless you, simply that. Okay. It's awful reading with someone else, even when you can't wait to hear them read, because you have to worry about using up that person's time and being a greedy pig. And frankly, when I get going, I don't want to stop. This is very hard. Okay. I'm going to read the title poem, Earth Elegy. Rain on the shingles, on the maples. This evening, ground fog and cloud mingled in the hollow between the ridges, and a sorrow so gentle it could be the mud I took this morning into my hands, lifting it from the garden's slump of soil and rind, from its cursive sprawl of blackened vine, turning the garden after hard frost seared from purple to black, the last cosmos. I put down the shovel and took the damp earth into my hands, and when I broke the soft clay open, found this twist of root left out of last year's harvest, sown over in spring, refired in the kill of summer, a hardened crust nearly hollow, a blind, bounded thing, so singular nothing might divine it. This is my body, broken. Once a sentence of breath spun so vividly round, I could put it on my tongue, and the words would halo and hallow and blur my descent into the barrow of unknowing each moment is. No words now, only this root humped like a burial mound and the hush of wondering what to pray. Knowing full well I have not loved, I have not suffered, endangered, or enjoyed enough of this world to relinquish it for another only made real by dying, or by living in the holy world of words apart from what they point to. Here now, just beyond the window glass, evening grosbeaks gust and go. On the sill of the quiet rain, I put the root, and I sit with it, into the night, watching and waiting, letting whatever words come go off on a spool of breath, until silken and sudden, from the pith comes forth, nodding on its stem of dawn this day, unfolding itself into the dark like a lily. And I sense the quick of it. So tenderly nearing, it brushes aside its own icon screen of bloom and root, black and gold. And I am crowned to bowl just this sun, so recklessly arising. A lot of my poems, as you can tell, especially the new ones, have a very contemplative and meditative focus. And I want to read, if I may, this longer poem called To Say Nothing of God, which is, you know, even when I walk in the woods, as you've already imagined, I mean, already heard, there's a sense of contemplativeness in the walking. When we came back from Pennsylvania to Connecticut one year, Pennsylvania, by the way, is where people, real people, shoot real deer for real food in the winter, and they need it. Anyway, we got back to Connecticut, and lo and behold, in the woods on our land, we found almost out of the woods and must have been going toward the pond, a stag, an 8-point buck. Dead. It was extremely cold, so the it was perfectly frozen, beautiful, no wound visible at that point. In Connecticut, of course, when a deer falls, there's a pack of poets running after it taking notes. And I don't really mean to put myself in their crowd, but I did, on daily walks, keep coming back to that buck and standing there and keep coming back and standing there. And it was a form of meditation, and it's a meditation on, of course, mortality and impermanence and the temporary blaze that we all are. And so I'll just read it. It's a long poem, and this will be my last one. To Say Nothing of God. Fattened all summer on wild raspberry, sarsaparilla, pond lilies, bedded down at noon in thickets of laurel and witch hobble, its pelage a rufescent shade near hazel, the rough boss at the base of its stark crown like oak bark. The stag, sensing me near, may have then pressed his head to the ground in camouflage, its antlers branches of red cedar sharply tipped, or the riven staves of shagbark the lightning sheared off in August. And I continuing to gather mint where the pond spilled into the brook, and I continuing to float with the water skimmers and the clouds, and I adrift in the burr of grasshoppers in the field lit by sun, by morning cloaks and monarchs. Now it's months past velvet, past rutting, and I'm wandering the winter slopes of dark cedars, crossing the lichened walls that rib the open woods. Even now I might have missed the buck, dead in its winter blue coat. A thick fur, I wait for the wind to riffle. No sign of breath or struggle for breath or wound, neither swollen nor caved in at the belly. Fallen on the run, its limbs splayed out, a frozen gait so like its ancestors drawn on the cave walls of Lascaux. And in my mouth, breath of its breath, a keening akin to the Anglo-Saxon and to the Slavic roots of wild spirit, beast, breath, God. In January, I chanced to find where the buck first fell before he gathered heavily each muscle, each neural fibril, each stellate cell, and rose up from the running cedar and mast and woodbine to clear the tumbled wall, to clear that last acre of silence, leaving behind him, shadowy, a flurry of coarse white hair, tufts from its tail and heaving belly. You are not this body which is born and dies on the surface of infinite mind, but these are words rising out of me. Do I believe them? Soon after sundown, the coyotes come, their shrill arias rising into a snow of stars, and the wind that blows quietly, freely, without striking words, follows me down to the buck, and the wind flows over the flattened, blue-flecked iris of the buck's open eye. The fox and the shrew eat their fill. I visit the buck each morning. I just stand there and look. I don't know why I do it. One hind leg torn off the haunch socket, flung over the shorn spine, the clean cave of the belly, soft parts eaten, the waste already shunted hot from the coyote's anus. Wind nests in the carcass, only a ridge of frozen meat, pale carnelian on ribs that curve like the tines of a rake. These are the spoils. Before the squirrels eat the antlers for calcium, we shear off the head and hang it by a cord from a rafter in the barn. It turns slowly, 5 feet in the air. Not a trophy, not a graven image. We want to bring skull and antlers inside the house to watch our comings in, our goings out, to turn us from daily parrying this task and that, are so crowded out of life we forget ourselves. The deer skull we boil gently, scraping it clean with a scalpel, oiling the antlers. We hang it white against a white wall above a wainscot of native hemlock. Sun and then moon fill the windows. The antlers pattern the wall with branched shadows, shagbark and oak. Light drifts into the curious reefs of lace alongside the bone snout. It roots in the feathered edges where the bone plates meet in a line that resembles the zigzag of inlets and outlets seen by a hawk above the archipelagic shore. I don't know what to make of the cribbled disc at the base of the skull, or the eye sockets, entirely open and set so far to the side of the head I can't match my gaze with its own. I touch my face, jut of brow and cheekbone. I touch the emptiness these will someday circle, and the light that will blaze when this body, intricate coracle, loosens and dissolves, borne away. If I should look for this place a century hence, the infinite focused anew in a body now of antler and fur, my long bones precisely hooved, stepping deftly into the open glade over a dusting of snow like today's, I should hope to be graced with an attention so keen I'd miss no creak of wood, no distant whir on the hard road, no tilted glide overhead in the pine grove. By then, this house would be simply a rib of stone wall, a slumped hollow for woods earth and bramble, this pond a mere seep beneath wire grass. No evidence of otter or cattail, no sign of the spruce we planted in the field, no black spikes of cedar on the ridge, although a tremor in memory may lift that antlered head toward where they grew. Once Orion rises and strings its bridge of years on fire across the emptiness I glimpse between them. Perhaps I might then, in the luck of being alive, be grateful enough not to mind the neon glow still sprawled across the sky. Grateful, perhaps, and enough at peace to sense boundless presence in whatever space is left open, too empty to profit by. Glad for goldfinch and junco puffed in the winter lilac, and for the sumac tall at the edge of the road, that bold candelabra lifted into lemony winter sun. I want to look ahead and know these acres of earth survive our human ignorance and greed, the air still clean enough to breathe, random stars, staghorn sumac, deer tracks in the snow. And the task at hand to disappear where I stand, but to stand in near tones of hush and mist in the early winter of morning bottom land, to stand in my body of ridge and pine, the sun turning lunar and silken. And the task at hand to mark the trail with a thick ring of bone slipped over a bare ripple of wild blueberry branch. Where marrow was an arrow of air points to the pine grove, the barred owls, warren of rabbits. To be here simply on a trail deer have etched into summer earth, and to know that the ground of the poem is oak leaves underfoot, deer droppings bright as black beans, a rumple of lichen on cold stone, a possum's jawbone, the teeth still sharp. And these words, a temporary blaze, a dust of snow. Thank you very, very much. I'm going to quit. I just have to tell you that I realized something reading that last poem, that you know, lots of times I feel pretty guilty for sitting around meditating, contemplating, et cetera, et cetera, and I've got a lot of poems that have to do with social action and other parts of the book. But the true end of contemplation is to realize that one is no other than anything else. In fact, we all are the same thing. I was reading that poem, and I just felt so completely identified with everything in there. The speaker did, rather. Okay, thank you.